You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Today, we're all looking for ways to save. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in, then flags any hidden errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Donald Trump has reversed his stance on TikTok shortly after a major donor talked to him. We have such a great show for you today. The New York Times' Nick Corasaniti tells us about Republicans' latest moves to purge the voter rolls. Then we'll talk to Frank McCourt about his new book, Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age. But first, we have the host of the Mary Trump Show, the one, the only Mary Trump. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Mary Trump.
Hey, Molly, how's it going?
I was going to like do a whole introduction about how much I like you, but I felt I would spare you because I feel like despite having the last name Trump, you are not a person for whom a 5-minute soliloquy about how much you like them is an ad.
No. it makes me wildly uncomfortable, in fact.
I thought I would save you.
Yeah.
You know, as a Nepo baby myself, you're obviously not a Nepo baby. You have a more complicated relationship with your, I like to call them qualifiers because it's a little homage to Al-Anon, but with your famous qualifier uncle, but I have a famous qualifier mother. And so when, you know, my sort of qualifier does something embarrassing, I feel quite a lot of embarrassment. Now, obviously, you are quite far removed and you have done everything beyond everything you could do to try and stop the freight train that is your uncle. But I want to ask you, as you see Lara Trump take over the RNC, not even Don Jr.'s wife, but Eric's wife, discuss.
Must I? Yes, I will. I just want to start by saying that it's different. Like, I don't take Donald's horrible behavior personally. Like, that doesn't embarrass me. What horrifies me and hurts me and wounds me still to this day is how many people are okay with it and enable him to do worse. You know, it's not his mocking President Biden's stutter, which just as a human being is, it, you know, offends me to the core. It's all of the people in the audience who laughed.
Yeah. No, I mean, I get it.
Yeah. I know. It's just like that's what we need to worry about. And here we are. The Republican National Committee is now, as somebody wrote on Twitter, I think, a subsidiary of the mom and pop shop known as the Trump Organization, which is infuriating in a totally different way. On the one hand, it's just a dangerous indicator of the dark slide we're on. towards the Banana Republic, which is the only kind of republic Donald is qualified to run. But it's also another reminder is that there will always be somebody or some entity, whether it's the RNC throwing the reins over to him or Chubb posting bond for him, there will always be somebody to bail him out, which is why we need to figure out a better way to box him in, because clearly money's not going to do it.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing, because when you're talking about that, and I'd love to talk for another minute about that, the story about how Trump did make fun of Biden for the stutter and the crowd loved it. And that was a sort of seminal moment in like the scraping of the bottom in which we are living. So I do think like that is really important thing to just sort of pause and think about for a minute. But the RNC giving itself up to Trump, I actually think that ultimately this is one of these careful of what you wish for things, right? Like the RNC, Rana had a relationship with a lot of the big donors. Big donors didn't want to give to the RNC because very wealthy people, obviously being wealthy is not what makes them understand it, but sophisticated investors, I think, know that that money is going to Trump's legal fees and not to down ballot candidates. And so for them, I think they were hesitant to give money to Trump. And what I was explained to me was that earlier on when Nikki Haley was still in it, a lot of large dollar donors gave to Nikki Haley because they felt that she represented a sort of more normal Republican Party, tax cuts without the fascism. Right? I mean, that's what they all want. But now she's out and the RNC needs money. And so Trump decided to put Lara in there. But Lara has a big problem, which is even though she's very attractive and they use her face now, I'm sure you saw that on the RNC fundraising emails, there are large dollar donors who are probably pretty pissed off that Trump fired all their people.
Yeah, at 60 and counting. I thought putting her face on the blood red banner was very, very well done. Listen, I agree with you that it is like the dog catching the car.
Yeah.
Okay. Now what? Well, now we're going to bankrupt the RNC because even though Republicans don't seem ever to remember this, Donald does nothing but bankrupt things and waste money and throw money away. You know, the fact that there's a real possibility he did not have the $88 million to come up with this bond is insane. So there's that.
Well, and then, and FYI, there's still more money that Trump needs to come up with.
A lot more money. $500 million more money. And probably more than that because he just defamed E. Jean Carroll again over the weekend. So
I know. That's right.
If he's going to be able to find other people to pay his way out of trouble, there's no incentive for him to stop defrauding, defaming, etc. And this whole RNC takeover is just another mechanism through which he plans to use other people's money to get himself out of trouble. Because that's one of the very few things he's good at is burning through other people's money. You know, the truth of the matter is that Lara Trump is just as qualified to run an organization as Donald. So they're in serious, serious trouble. And at this point, I think the only hope for the party, not that I care about the future of the Republican Party, is if for Nikki Haley not to endorse Donald and try to draw a line. You know, otherwise it's his party now and forever.
Yeah, no. I think that's right. And I also think that if you wanted to have a Republican Party that was normal at some point, and again, I don't. So, right. You know, I don't give a fuck. I'm happy to see them all go the way of the Whigs. But if you were a conservative who wanted lower taxes but not authoritarianism, you would tell Nikki Haley to keep her powder dry and to wait this one out and to come back in 2025 when the bloodbath is over and try to rebuild from the ashes. And maybe that's how that plays out. Or maybe Trump wins and we're all in Gitmo together with Jimmy Kimmel.
Yes, Jimmy Kimmel and you and I and others have 79 days to flee. So it's not, you know, thankfully.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for that. 79 days. A lot can happen in 79 days. Side of presidency. Good point. That's what's so weird about this moment in American life is like every sort of rational instinct I have says that Trump is absolutely just. Look, Trump is running for president so he doesn't go to jail. I mean, I didn't even say that. That was Republican, one of the Republicans running against him, you know, in the primary. Who said, you know, he's running so he doesn't go to jail. So, I mean, he's running so he doesn't go to jail. And Republicans are still scared of him because of Twitter, right? I mean, that's what this is. Or because they're worried that they'll get primaried.
Yeah, that's all this is. It's absolutely mind-blowing that in 8 years, you know, he is completely this weak, pathetic, and now quite old man. Has remade this entire party into his image. And where do you go from there? Because if things go the way they should go and he loses, and the fact that we've had to worry about it is such a horrific indictment of our system, but we'll have to deal with that at another time. If he loses, who will ever trust this party again? Like, this party has no room to pivot to anything else, which I agree with you is a very good thing.
Yeah.
Let it burn to the ground. We need something entirely else. We need two parties. One is a progressive liberal party, and the other one's a central left party. That's what we need in this country.
Listen, I'll take it, man.
Yep.
I mean, you know.
We've never tried that. We've tried center right and fascism. Let's try center left and progressive. Please.
Yeah, that sort of seems like where we are. So Lara's going to run the RNC. Republicans are going to try to make the case that Trump is totally fine and that Biden is the one with the problems. On Monday, Trump called in to Squawk Box. Was it Squawk Box? CNBC? His guy, his Roy Cohen at CNBC. By the way, I feel so bad for all the serious people who work at CNBC who like have to live in like mortal embarrassment of that Joe guy. But anyway, called in and spent like 2 hours, an hour. I mean, some crazy amount of time. Oh, yeah. Gosh. And said and was all through like just rambling, had thoughts about oil. You know, a lot of like hot takes from the 1980s, what the last time Trump read a newspaper. And it was bad. I mean, how do you square that?
It seems pretty simple to me. Corporate media has, for whatever reason, decided.
I'm going to just tell you CNN's take on it. Trump's freewheeling CNBC interview gives glimpse of the campaign to come.
Yeah, that was at the Post or CNN?
CNN. Freewheeling.
But this is the thing. It's like Biden and Donald debate democracy.
Trump says it's bad. Biden says it's good.
It's like one of them incited an insurrection to overthrow one. The other one, So this is what we're dealing with. A corporate media that when they do find something Donald has done or said newsworthy, they put it on page 25. Otherwise, it's all just baked in. He's a rapist, so what do we need to talk about that for? I mean, come on, we know that he is. I cannot believe we're still having this conversation since 2015, but they normalize all of it so that, and between that and the delays in the judiciary, which topic for, another time, because that is potentially more dangerous. And I think in the long term, more dangerous by delaying. Thank you, Merrick Garland, the January 6th trial and the document stuff. What's the message people who don't pay that much attention get and are maybe inclined to want the status quo, not to rock any boats? The message is it can't be that important if it's taking so long. What's the big deal then?
I'm just going to interject a little bit of Donald. This is from the interview. I feel like I'm a pioneer, Trump said, of the indictments and the judgments against him. What's happening is we have to be very careful. By the way, I love the idea that this guy is literally just running because of the legal challenges, right? Like he's trying to make a case that somehow defendant Trump and candidate Trump are the same person. What's happening is we have to be very careful. You know, we have a very fragile country, right? He's talking about his legal cases here. People are rejecting it and they are watching.
Wow. Okay. So we got projection. We've got paranoia. We've got a description of the interior of his brain. Yes. Jesus. So that's just fine. And meanwhile, who is doing anything to tell him otherwise.
There's no grown-up in the Republican Party.
There's no grown-up in the RNC. Think about what's happening with his cases, which is nothing. He's right. saying everything needs to be delayed because of the immunity case in front of the Supreme Court, which in its infinite wisdom doesn't seem to think it's an emergency. And meanwhile, two out of those three federal cases is on hold because of that. He wants the third one on hold, the one in New York for election fraud.
Right.
And
yes.
I was just thinking about that this morning. It's like, okay, he's asking for immunity. He's not asking the Supreme Court to say that he committed no crime. So can't we, in the meantime, find out if he committed a crime? And then either way, like, if he gets immunity, it won't matter. But it at least we'll know. Like, it doesn't have to interfere with adjudicating the facts and evidence, does it? It's making me crazy.
Yes, agreed. And I think also what we're seeing here is that this whole lie that the guardrails held, no, they didn't fucking hold, right? Like, the guy did an insurrection and all the people down the scale, right? The violent people, the people who smeared the feces on the wall of the halls of Congress, those people, right? The guy who put his feet on the desk of Nancy Pelosi, those people, a lot of those people are either in jail or paying huge fines. You know who's not in jail or paying huge fines?
Let me guess. Can you give me a hint? Anybody responsible for planning the goddamn thing, that's who's not in jail up to and including Donald Trump.
Right. But the one good thing, I think, and I'm curious what you think about this, is a number of people think that because these sort of lower downs were taken in, that there's a sense in which these people are less likely to do violence.
Okay, but
I mean, it's a pretty pathetic bright spot, but it's all we have.
I don't even know if it is a bright spot. First of all, on the guardrails didn't hold. And by the way, we don't know how the insurrection ended yet because it's not over. He'll pardon all of them on day one of his dictatorship. So it gets erased from history, as it practically has been anyway. I don't know. I mean, there are all sorts of things that have been shown not to be deterrent. And he's had the opportunity, because of the failures of the system, to activate even more people, to get them even more angry and feel more aggrieved. I don't think so. I mean, it's like the same reason people smoke. I'm not going to be the one who gets sick. People have ways of convincing themselves that their cause is so righteous, or, you know, the pleasure they get out of the activity is so worth it that the consequences don't even enter into their consciousness. So we're talking about a situation in which if he loses, and especially if the Electoral College's margin is very narrow in Biden's favor, do we really think people are going to say, well, you know, 4 years ago, people get went to jail? No. They're going to be so triggered, intentionally triggered or activated or whatever the word you want to use. And I don't actually think that the rational consideration of consequences is going to come into play for anybody.
That's really scary. Mary Trump, I hope
it's
you'll
my
come
job.
Back. I also think you're probably right. Now that I'm listening to you, I think you're probably right.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Today, we're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. When I first heard about it, I thought, it's about time. This makes sense. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in for savings. Let's say you, your spouse, or kids see the doctor or other medical provider when your claims come in, HealthLock automatically renews them and flags any errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. So you pay only what you owe. This is your money, your saving. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped members save more than $130 million. I get it. Medical billing errors can happen, but you should be able to pay with confidence. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden medical bill errors. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com. One place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Nick Corasaniti is a reporter at the New York Times covering voting and democracy. Welcome to Fast Politics, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
It feels like you've been doing the voter beat a little bit. We want to talk to you about Trump's allies ramp up campaign targeting voter rolls. That sounds scary. What does that mean?
So what this is kind of like a continuation and escalation of what's become a kind of common tactic among a lot of, you know, right-wing activists and volunteers and some leaders to try and, in their minds, clean the voter rolls. But what they're actually doing is combing through voter rolls, using their own kind of software that they've developed and trying to identify voters that they think are erroneously on the rolls and challenge them to get them kicked off the rolls. Now, they're doing this through a bunch of different methods, and a few that we've uncovered are pretty aggressive and might even have like either created a loophole or an actual conflict between state law and federal law, kind of protecting voters from being removed from any kind of voting rolls, either quickly or, you know, without due process.
I want you to just talk us through where this is happening and what it looks like for my dad, who is actually quite smart, but who might not be completely read in on this.
Sure. So this is happening state by state. And because our electoral system
in every state,
I can't say that for sure, because as I was just about to say, the United States electoral system is so decentralized. Each state runs their own elections. And in some states, they just punt it down to counties, and in some states, they even punt it down to municipalities. So in Michigan, for example, there is state law, but they're really run by 1,600, you know, local election offices at the municipal level. So it's really hard to get a national grasp of how wide this challenge effort is and, you know, kind of exactly how aggressive they're going all over the country. Now, we've identified some areas. We kind of focused on battleground states because that's where, you know, this could maybe have a bigger impact in 2024. In almost every battleground state, there are activists seeking to challenge voters and get them removed from the rolls, often before the 2024 election.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. Trump world knows that this is not a game of the popular vote. This is a game of the swing states. But what this would look like is you go in to vote and you're not on the rolls anymore.
That would be the kind of worst case scenario that could happen. And, you know, we've identified a few voters who were removed from the rolls and were kind of unaware of it until they were either notified by like activists on the other side, or, you know, journalists found problems, presented them to election officials, and they had to redo what they had done. But the worst case scenario would be, yes, that you show up to vote and your registration has either been canceled or is in a challenged phase where you would need to present more than, say, just like a simple identification to prove that you are indeed registered to vote, live in that, you know, jurisdiction and things like that.
What would be the argument that Trump's people are using to deregister them, basically?
So it does vary state to state. And these are, you know, a very loose network of activists, some, you know, with kind of more direct ties to, say, the Trump orbit, like Cleta Mitchell, you know, who was a lawyer helping him in 2020 to overturn the results.
Where is Cleta working?
Cleta has a very loose national umbrella organization, and challenges has been, you know, one of her main pushes. She argues that, you know, voter rolls are dirty and they need to be cleaned up, and no one is being disenfranchised. If anything, allowing rolls to stay, quote unquote, dirty is diluting the votes of legal voters. A common argument you hear on the conservative side.
That sounds like a lie, though, because we know that there aren't illegal and legal voters. If you're registered to vote, you are a legal voter.
What I feel like needs to be said every time, but is, you know, sometimes we operate as if it's just an understood thing, is that voter fraud in the United States is exceedingly, exceedingly rare.
Yes.
There's, you know, maybe dozens or, like, you know, in the low hundreds number of fraud or fraudulent registration or anything like that every cycle. It's always a little bit that happens, but nothing that ever comes close to any kind of margin, especially, you know, what former President Trump says, like in the hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands.
That's right. No, never this happened. Is bullshit.
Never happened in American history, and you know, kind of can't, given all of the systems we have in place to check for that. What a lot of these activists are doing is seizing on either state laws or procedures and trying to go a little bit further than, say, the average voter roll cleanup process would go. So, for example, in Michigan, activists found a law from 1954 that has been kind of rarely used and referenced. And what this law says is that any elector in the state can challenge another elector, singular, with a, like, affidavit or official attestation that they know that that elector doesn't live here anymore. And that starts a process that, you know, sends out a card to the voter to check. And if they don't respond within 30 days, they get removed from the rolls.
So this is like using the Comstock Act to stop people from getting the abortion pill in the mail, right? Like, it wasn't originally made for this. It's just Republicans have tried to figure out a way to use it.
I think it's a little different than the Comstock Act, because that is certainly, like, kind of two different areas. This is a law from 1954 that is indeed designed to kind of help keep voter rolls clean, but it was never designed to be a mass challenge tool, which is, you know, kind of what has happened in the post-2020 election. Is these activists aren't challenging a couple voters here or there. They're challenging hundreds or thousands, or in Georgia, tens of thousands. This was never designed for that. It also wasn't necessary. It was designed to kind of help stop, like, a lot of mail going to the wrong place. And, you know, in the 50s, when that was a popular way of campaigning, it was designed to kind of ease the burden of campaigning on residents. So it certainly wasn't designed to have this mass removal effect. That law also, you know, it was passed in 54, but it is kind of in direct conflict with the NVRA, which is a national law that says, you know, if a voter is challenged and they're, you know, to be removed from the rolls, you need two federal election cycles to go through before they're officially removed. So this sets up a conflict where election officials are told by these activists, you have to remove these people in 30 days. You have to follow the law. It's the law. If not, you know, we'll raise official complaints. But then they're also, you know, remembering their training that, well, wait, the national, you know, the NVRA says, no, it's two federal election cycles. So it's that level of detail that I think we're seeing is evidence of this expansion and this kind of accelerated effort to try and challenge voters and remove them from the rolls in these key battleground states.
So are there people on the left making sure this doesn't happen, or is it just going along unchecked?
Well, I think a lot of election officials are starting to catch up to this. You know, when you look at different states, there's different levels of preparedness. So Michigan is kind of receiving this first big wave right now that, you know, wasn't as prevalent, say, in the midterms. Whereas in Georgia, in the Senate runoff elections in 2021, you know, kind of immediately following the 2020 election, that their election day was January 6th, there was 360,000 challenges to voters just in that small runoff window.
Wow.
In Georgia.
Yeah, because they thought that would help them win. You don't have to editorialize. I will. Continue.
There's actually email evidence showing that they did indeed think if you did these challenges and clean these rolls, it would have helped at least Trump make up his deficit in the trial between Fair Fight and True the Vote. That email was, you know, brought into evidence. But so Georgia county election officials are very, very, very well versed in the challenge law and the challenge preparation. So they're, you know, doing their best to make sure no one is erroneously removed. As for like organizations on the left who are, you know, seeking to either right these wrongs or anything, there's certainly some, I'm sure. I haven't necessarily focused on them in my reporting, but there's voting rights groups in every state. There's, you know, Fair Fight in Georgia, the ACLU, that, you know, are looking to prevent this. But I'm not as aware as to their operations or measures at the state level.
So crazy. Speaking of voting, there is a Democratic primary in New Jersey for the Senate. And you have a really important piece about this. And basically, and again, as a beneficiary of nepotism myself, I always am hesitant to call it bad. No, I'm just kidding. It's bad. Talk to me about these ballots.
So what's unique in New Jersey is in the primary system, they have a thing called the line. And what that is, it's a specific column or row on a physical ballot in each county where a candidate is given preferential treatment. So if you win the line in, say, Hudson County for the Democrats, you appear with all the other Democrats from county freeholder to senator, all in one line that, you know, gives the impression that these are the official Democratic candidates. And then other candidates can be all over the place. And some are put in what's known as ballot Siberia, which is, you know, 4 to 10 columns over. And you wouldn't even know if, unless you were looking for them. So it's this system that creates, you know, an appearance of an official endorsement that if you're a Democratic voter, these are the people you should vote for. And that's on the physical ballot. Now, how the line is won varies from county to county, but often in a lot of situations, the county party chair carries immense influence over the line endorsement. In some, it's just the county chair and a few others. In some, it's this committee. In others, their endorsement helps guide the precinct delegates who are going to vote for this. And then in others, it truly is an open convention. What's really unique about this already unique system in New Jersey is that this year, Tammy Murphy, the first lady, is running for Senate and seeking the line in different counties while her husband, Governor Murphy, is still the sitting governor and will be next year. So he's in charge of the next two budgets for New Jersey. Now, each of these county chairs in their personal lives has some business tied to the state. Some are lobbyists, some are lawyers, some have state government positions and are drawing state government paychecks. So regardless of necessarily, you know, how they're going to step back and view the race between Tammy Murphy and Andy Kim as the other most, you know, prominent candidate running, they're going to have their own financial interests in the back of their head. So we saw very quickly, as soon as Tammy Murphy announced, all of these powerful county chairs fall in line and immediately endorse her. It was within, I think, a week, most of the major population centers fell. And that bothered a lot of, you know, Democratic-based voters in New Jersey who saw it as either a coronation or an anointing or kind of moving beyond the simple open primary process that, you know, they claim to support. So as evidence, I think, of how angry some of these voters are at the open conventions, Andy Kim, who was considered an underdog to Tammy Murphy, has been winning most of these open conventions, including one in Monmouth, which kind of set the pace for exactly how this primary is starting to play out. So it's this weird system in New Jersey that's always had a little bit to a lot of insider power, smoke-filled back rooms, back dealing, that this year was so much more at the forefront simply due to the dynamics of the first lady running while the sitting governor is still in office and will be in office next year.
That is crazy. And really, the ballot stuff is really unusual. Like, there are 49 other states and nobody else has that.
As far as I know.
That's what Andy told us.
Yeah.
But it could be wrong.
It would shock me because, I mean, granted, I am from New Jersey and a proud, proud and loud New Jerseyan, but I've, you know, written a couple articles about this over the past 5 years and have never heard anyone else say, oh, this is how we do it. You know, it's certainly, maybe they did years ago. It certainly has, you know, those relics of political machines. And New Jersey is one of the few states where like political machines really do still matter. About 6 or 7 years ago, George Norcross was at the height of his power as this unelected but powerful insurance broker from South Jersey who really commanded the entire South Jersey delegation and could, you know, force bend governors to his will, both Murphy and former Governor Chris Christie. Now there's, you know, the Hunterdon County political machine that's the most popular county populace, so they move, or as most Democratic voters, so they can move a lot. So New Jersey still is very much a political machine state, whereas in other states, we've seen machines completely crumble and fall. Just, you know, looking at AOC's election, that was actually a long time ago, but it feels like a few years ago.
I want to get to a piece you wrote pretty recently. Racial turnout gap has widened with a weakened Voting Rights Act. So in 2013, the Supreme Court, Justice Roberts weakened that some of these protections were no longer necessary. And surprise, surprise, what happened?
Well, what's kind of always been presumed is that when you've removed the kind of most critical part of the Voting Rights Act, that it would have negative impact on communities of color and turnout among voters of color. But up until this Brennan study that, you know, was completed a few weeks ago, those attempts at kind of quantifying this possible change was left to either exit polling or opinion surveys or the census, all of which are like a little bit more imperfect than what Brennan decided to do, which was take about a billion voter files from multiple elections since 2013 and assess exactly what has happened in all the counties and states that were covered by this part of the Voting Rights Act that was changed in 2013. And what they found was that, you know, it was a 5% difference that had the Shelby decision not happened, the racial gap in these counties and states would have been 5% lower than it is right now. And 5% is a significant margin in modern elections. I mean, so many as swing states, you know, are within 2 to 3. And some of these counties that were, you know, under Section 5 are massive counties. Harris County, you know, in Texas is bigger than I think 23 states in terms of population. That's home to Houston. What they found was, you know, kind of a statistical proof that the Shelby County decision did indeed exacerbate the racial turnout gap and that it went beyond other like qualifiers that people have often sought. So it persists across class, income, education lines. Even in poorer communities, while turnout was down amongst poorer communities across the line, there was still a greater racial gap. You know, poorer white voters still voted at a greater turnout than poorer voters of color. At the very wealthy, wealthier white voters still voted at a higher rate than voters of color. And they found this racial turnout gap growing nationwide over the past 10 years since the 2012 election. But it grew at a faster rate in these former Shelby counties.
It's not surprising, but it's still upsetting. Do you think that enough attention is being paid to this voter roll stuff?
It's tough for me to say, you know, where people should be focusing their attention. I do think election officials are becoming, you know, more familiar with the challenges, with the rules and regulations that are guiding what should be done to keep voters on the rolls or not. I do think probably the biggest challenge to this challenge program, for like repeating myself, is that these election officials are still overworked and underfunded. In the, I forget if it was the budget or another recent funding bill or whatever fiscal cliff we decided to near a shutdown over, there was money, you know, that was supposed to be given to run the 2024 election, and that kept getting whittled down to nowhere near what the request was. And so even with HABA funds and the other federal money that's given to elections, it's just simply not enough. And there's been, you know, new laws that keep out other forms of funding elections, outside funding of elections. So these local officials are really kind of, you know, between a rock and a hard place. And so when you layer in all of this extra work of sifting through these challenges, making sure you're both protecting everyone's right to vote while at the same time not, you know, erroneously keeping someone who shouldn't be on the rolls, it's a massive effort. And so while they're having to do this, they're still having to make sure polling locations are open in the right place, make sure that they're doing the right testing of the machines, making sure that like voting locations have the right power to power the machines. Like we saw that in the Georgia primary in 2020. So, you know, there's so much that goes into this and there's so much that these election officials have to do. And often they're volunteers or they're part time. And so to layer on all of these challenges, I think, is something that there hasn't been the proper kind of relief, either adding help to them or financial help to them. That, I think, is kind of where the biggest gap is at the moment.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Frank McCourt is the founder of Project Liberty and author of Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age. Welcome to Fast Politics, Frank.
Well, Molly, it's great to be with you. Looking forward to the conversation.
Explain to us how you got to this idea.
like you and millions of others, I see and feel what's wrong, and it, something's wrong, right? Something's big as a miss. And so I get curious about that and started to dig into it. And that's where I, you know, came to the conclusion that all these things that, you know, we find creepy and all the harms that we see being done, or many of them, can be linked back to how technology is currently being used and how the internet has been almost hijacked, right, by a few big companies. And I, you know, I say that and should mention that I'm a fifth generation builder, and my family's been building infrastructure for over 130 years. And my great-great-grandfather started building roads when Henry Ford started building cars. So it's kind of hardwired. We look at problems and, you know, try to figure out what's wrong and go fix it. I brought that mentality, let's say, to this problem. But I'll tell you one anecdote that really stuck with me. And this was after I had started a public policy school with Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And, you know, that was at 2013. And we knew that big data was important. And we put a massive data institute inside of the McCord School. And a faculty member there who was doing great research, it told me the following story. She had a theory that you could predict when a large-scale human migration was going to occur by seeing what words got amplified on social media. And she developed this theory based on what she was able to pull together on, you know, publicly available social media. Our government was quite interested in that project and gave her $200,000 to refine her model, because if there was, in fact, a predictor of large-scale migration, that would be massively helpful to humanitarian organizations and society more broadly. So, yeah, she got a couple hundred thousand to do the project, and New Twitter had the information she needed and went to them to get the data. And they said, yep, we have it, but it will cost you $100,000.
Wow.
And she said, I can't give you $100,000 because I'll get the data, but I won't be able to do the project because I don't have the budget. And they said, well, you can't have it then. So that really said a lot to me, Molly, because A, you have the most vulnerable people in the world who created the data, right?
It
was their conversations that this academic who was not going to commercialize this, just wanted to improve, you know, the lot of society, help these poor souls. And they have Twitter, who's sitting on this data and saying, it's mine, you can't have it unless you pay me. And I just felt the entire internet was upside down. It's our data, we should own it and control it. If we want to use it for a good purpose, we should be able to do that. And we shouldn't be held hostage by big platforms. And by the way, they are making massive amounts of money. So
on our data.
Yeah, from our data. So let's share in that as well, the value.
It's such an interesting solve. I'm hoping you could sort of talk us through. The idea is actually quite complicated, or at least it's complicated to someone like me who knows many things very superficially. But I'm hoping you could sort of explain to us this idea, because if it were to exist, it would be a decentralized internet, right?
Yeah, well, it would be decentralized to the extent that we'd be in control, right? And we'd own and control our data, and we'd have visibility and how it's being used, and we'd be able to share in the value. But, you know, the internet was built as a decentralized technology. That's why it was built. You know, it was built to so that we had a decentralized form of communication in the event of an attack way back from the Soviet Union. And then it evolved into the World Wide Web. And that, by the way, was 35 years ago today. Tim Berners-Lee released HTTP into the world, and the World Wide Web was created. And, you know, I've talked to him extensively about this, and his intention was that it be a decentralized, human-centric, empowering internet, one that would be the proverbial tide that lifts all boats, right? Something where we could share information and get smarter as a society, and not something that it became 15 years later, and especially over the last 10 years, which has been a highly centralized, autocratic, surveillance-based, app-based internet. The apps have taken ownership of, they've hijacked the internet. So, you know, what I say in my book, Our Biggest Fight, which comes out today, is that we're back where we were when Thomas Paine in 1775 wrote Common Sense, that powerful call to arms, you know, the pamphlet that he wrote before the United States became the United States. And he said to his fellow settlers at the time, you have a choice. You could continue to be a subject of a monarch and not have any rights to speak of or be able to own anything, or you could choose to be a citizen. And with that comes all kinds of rights, including, you know, you're born with, you know, what became known as unalienable rights, the rights that you're born with the same rights the king has. And you're a human being of worth, and you have freedom, you have liberty, you have choice, autonomy, agency, and you can own things. and create value. And that, and happily, we chose citizenship and we created this great country. And I would argue that we, as you say, we can make this complicated if we want to, but I actually think it's pretty simple. Now we're at another juncture. We have a choice. We can be dragged into a future by machines and be subjects again and lose our citizenship. Or we can create technology that actually allows us and celebrates the fact that we are now digital citizens. We're being treated like subjects. We're losing our rights. And we're not treated at all like human beings on the current internet. And so I asked the question, why, pray tell, would we give up all of our rights for the ability to use the internet? It makes no sense.
Right. At one time, it was not thought of as giving up all of our rights. But now, in hindsight, that was what we were all doing. So what I think is cool about this idea is that you are doing this as an act of philanthropy, right? You are not making money on this idea. You're really trying to sort of go in and make something that is really wrong right. If Congress wanted to, they could do this right now, right? I mean, wouldn't that solve many of our technological problems if they said, like, no, we're going to have this decentralized internet. Everyone needs to be a real person. No more bot farms. Like, if you have to have a birth certificate or a driver's license or a passport, you have to have a digital identity. I mean, there's a world where that happens, right?
There's a world where that happens, but it's obviously not going to happen in the world we live in, because our politics is also become highly polarized and dysfunctional because of the same technology that I'm referring to that is designed to polarize us and separate us. It's not designed to help us reach consensus. Reaching consensus is no fun for an algorithm that's designed to keep you online endlessly and in a triggered state, constantly, you know, responding to something someone says. So let's go back to your premise, though. DSNP is an open source protocol that our labs team developed that would allow people to own and control their data, as you say, have a digital entity, and let all of us benefit from the network effect of the internet. Open source, it's been gifted to humanity. People need to build on this, Molly, for it to be a real thing. And so there will be lots of commercial endeavors that people will engage in. Our own team will probably engage in some things that they build on this protocol, because without it, there's not going to be a real alternative to the current internet. So, but the point is, it needs to be built on by millions of people. This is not a, you know, one person, one family, one company project. Right. It's never going to happen. This is a collective action, and we need to demand a better internet. Now, if the government wanted to say, hey, everybody needs to adopt a protocol like DSNP, then that would help move things along. We don't need the government to mandate it, is the point.
Right. But if they did, it would be solved tomorrow.
It would be accelerated, sure. And then suddenly you'd be in a situation where we adopted other standards, right? We adopted other protocols. And what we didn't know when we were adopting them is that we were giving power to a few big platforms to own us. And I don't want to be owned by someone else, whether it's the Chinese government because of, you know, TikTok, or whether it's the, you know, a few big American platforms. We need to put human beings in charge of themselves on the internet for the first time, right? We need to stop being an IP address, a device, or stop just being viewed as data, as a product. We're human beings. It's a privilege to use the internet, and we should be required to be a person, or at least verified as such, to be on the internet. That doesn't mean we have to give up our privacy or anything like that. We should be able to live on the internet like we lived prior to that, where if you're dealing with a community that you know and trust well, you share a lot of details about yourself. But if you're dealing with strangers, you don't share anything about yourself. You or I don't share things about ourselves when we walk down a city street to a stranger. At least most people don't. But then when you get to know people, you share more. And then when you have close friends and significant others and family members, you share a lot. Well, the internet should operate in a similar way, where we have control over what's shared about us, with whom, and on what terms.
So right now we're in the middle of a news cycle about TikTok, where it looked for a minute like TikTok was going to be either forced as a sale or banned. And there was like an incredible amount of movement. And now it looks like that's not happening, because Kellyanne Conway is a lobbyist for TikTok and Trump, some people got to Trump. And so I'm just curious, is that the problem with tech regulation? This is like an obsession of mine. For example, you know, there are always congressional hearings about tech regulation. We're constantly seeing that, but we're not actually seeing any regulation come out of any of this. I mean, we have seen so much like carnage from technology, a lot of great stuff too, but a lot of carnage. It seems like our Congress and our politicians just seem completely uninterested in providing any kind of regulation.
Yeah. When you said, you know, there's carnage and there's a lot of harm, but there's good stuff being done too. I actually hear myself kind of saying that from time to time. And I hear others saying it. Like, it's almost like we're a defense mechanism or this obligation to say, well, there's some good stuff too. And I've come to the conclusion, and if we get our construction company, right, or some municipality or somebody built a plumbing system, a water system for a city of 1 million people, and we turned on the water, or people turned on the water in their homes, and 600,000 people got clean, healthy, nutritional water, and 400,000 people got toxic poison water that was causing illnesses and even some people to die, would we be saying, oh, but the water system, that water system does some good stuff too? Or would we be focusing on the damage that's done and be saying, fix that? That's unacceptable. So I just want to put this in context that I think we have to stop being apologetic. Oh, yeah, but they do some good things too. And just say, enough is enough. Number one. Number two, on your issue of policy and so forth, we now know, and we learn more and more every day, about the damage being done by the way the internet is being used and, you know, this surveillance technology, the harms to democracy, our information ecosystem is being contaminated, we have trouble with civil discourse, there's police officers at school board meetings, and most importantly, we see the harms to young people, right? And they're very real. The first stop should be to go to these big tech platforms and say, look, there's damage being done. Fix it. Stop causing the damage, right? Stop putting the water into the pipe. Stop. Fix this. And that hasn't been done. And what we get is these apology tours and, oh, I didn't know that. Go back and check and fix it. But then information comes out. And of course, we now learn they knew it, you know, that Mark Zuckerberg knew that the technology was designed to prey on young kids and so on and so forth. And yet, it's still not fixed. So then where do we turn? We turn to our elected officials and our political system, right? Like we did with tobacco, for instance, right? And when we found out it was harmful and the tobacco companies didn't fix it, we went to our elected officials and said, please, we need new regulations because they're not fixing it themselves. And then those regulations came into place. There were warnings on cartons. There was a tax put on it so that it was more expensive. So people would buy less and people were it was an educational campaign. And there were regulations and laws, and you couldn't smoke under a certain age, so on and so forth. You couldn't sell to a certain age. And our political apparatus went into gear. So now let's come back to technology. We go to our political apparatus and say, big tech isn't in these social media platforms, aren't fixing themselves. Please fix the problem. And like you say, we see the theater, we see the hearings, but nothing happens. I've come to the conclusion that either our political elected officials are not understanding the technology and the harm it's doing, or they are taking money from these big platforms that are the wealthiest companies ever created and have lobbyists and advocates all over the place, or they're actually, and this may be the most damaging of all, they're using the very platforms that we're talking about here that are doing the damage and causing the polarization to raise money and take extreme views and get followers and clicks and donations. And so it's the ultimate irony here, or sad irony, is that what I talk about in our biggest fight that we need to fix is the very technology that is disabling our political apparatus as well and our ability to adopt good policies, which used to happen years ago and is not happening now because of the all-powerful nature of this technology. So that's where I come to the Project Liberty and the need for us to actually take matters into our own hands, actually diagnose the engineering problem, fix it, and then have a call to action to demand that we have this alternative and incentivize builders to build on it and get citizens, people demanding the alternative. And I want to see people talking about this at their kitchen table, at the sidelines of the soccer, kids' soccer game, at their school board meetings, you know, after church and so on and so forth, so that we start to socialize this, because we, the people, need to fix this, because the platforms themselves aren't fixing it and our elected officials are not fixing it.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I just ask that your listeners, you know, take a couple of hours and read Our Biggest Fight. And because it's hard in 20 minutes to get everything across. But, you know, the book that I had the privilege of writing with Michael Casey, I think does a decent job of explaining the problem and the solution. So we don't have to be helpless and hopeless here. There is hope and there is a bright future. And we're definitely pro-technology. It's not about being anti-tech. We're definitely pro-tech, but use it the right way. Or your listeners can go to ourbiggestfight.com and learn much more about the project.
Thank you.
Thank you, Molly.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jung Fast. Robert Herr takes the stand in Congress today, and
And he reveals himself to be the partisan hack we had suspected he was. There were a lot of moments to choose from. I say just play the whole hearing at the DNC, but if you're pressed for time, definitely there were so many moments. The best and the worst was him. So Ted Lieu asked Robert Herr questions that were purportedly about Biden, but really about Trump. That was a pretty amazing moment. Just in a very typical Republican fashion, before the report came out, Herr, you know, sort of got ahead of it and said that at points Biden couldn't remember the day that Beau died, which is actually just a lie, because when you look at the transcript, he knew exactly what the day was. And then he was sort of trying to figure out if it was 2015 or 2016. But Madeleine Dean said he did know the day, and Herr refused to admit it, went back to the transcript, and then ultimately just punted. So I thought that was the moment, but there were a lot of incredible moments in that hearing. It's worth going over them. And it's really clear that, like, the mainstream media fucked up, right? They ran Herr's comments just like they did when they used Bill Barr's comments about the Mueller investigation instead of using the actual Mueller investigation. They took Republicans' word for it. They let them shape the narrative. And we've seen this before. So we lived through weeks and weeks of Joe Biden didn't know when Beau Biden died, when in fact he knew exactly when Beau Biden died. And so for that, partisan hack Robert Herr, who, by the way, refused to answer a question when Eric Swalwell asked him if he would take an appointment in Trump's White House. Partisan hack Herr is our moment of fuckery. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having seven kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.